Welcome to the Agile Book Club podcast, where we hang out and talk shop with the authors whose ideas are shaping the agile landscape. Here is your host, Paul Klipp.
Welcome back to the Agile Book Club, the podcast where we turn the pages of innovation and script the narrative of tech evolution, one author at a time. I'm your host, Paul Klipp, and today we're diving into a world where time is a currency more precious than gold, and meetings, well, let's just say they're on the endangered species list. Imagine a world in which this could have been an email isn't just a meme, but a mantra. A world where your calendar isn't a collage of overlapping Zoom calls, but a canvas of possibilities. This is not a utopian dream, my friends, but the core message of the Async First Playbook, a revolutionary guide to replacing draining meetings with asynchronous collaboration tools. Picture this. Instead of spending your mornings nodding off in virtual rooms wondering if anyone would notice if you accidentally hit stop video, you're crafting succinct, meaningful updates. Updates that your team can absorb and respond to at their own pace, in their own time, leading to more thoughtful, productive interactions. Now I know what you're thinking. But what about my carefully curated background of strategically placed books and that one succulent that I just can't kill? Fear not. They do not have to go to waste. They'll become the backdrop of your next level asynchronous video messages, where every plant and book spine is a silent testament to your commitment to cutting edge collaboration. So in today's episode, we're joined by the author of the Async First Playbook, who will now walk us through how we can transform our workdays from a series of monologues into a symphony of syncopated productivity. We'll explore how asynchronous tools can not only save our time, but also salvage our sanity. So before you send out that calendar invite for yet another quick catch-up, join us. It's time to learn how to trade in your meeting marathon shoes for something a bit more comfortable, and perhaps a bit more revolutionary. Join me now in welcoming Sumeet Moghe, author of the Async First Playbook. For our listeners who haven't read the book yet, one of the things that I observe in this book is that you build a case on the back of a lot of the books that we've talked about on this podcast. You've done your reading, and there's a lot of books out there about remote working that touch on this tangentially, like the works of 37 Signals, Team Topologies, etc. What was it that was missing in that conversation about remote work that made your book necessary?
That's a good question indeed. And it's one of those questions that I tried to answer even when I was building out my book proposition. And I think part of the answer is in your question itself, that many of these books address the notion of asynchronous work tangentially. And in my experience, having worked with a lot of teams, everyone gets that we have too many meetings. But when you're in the flow of your everyday work and you've got a stand-up planned every day, you've got sprint planning meetings planned every other week, you've got showcases planned, you're doing ad hoc huddles and things like that, it's very difficult to pause and say, all right, what would be an asynchronous variant of it? The average practitioner is saying, all right, I get we need to do pure meetings, but can you tell me practice by practice by practice, how do I do this in my day-to-day work? And if you notice the structure of the book, you will probably notice that there is probably the meatiest part of the book, which is called The Practitioner's Guide. And I don't intend for the book to be one that somebody reads from cover to cover. What I intend for people to do is to pick up practices that are relevant in their particular scenario and say, all right, I want an asynchronous variant of it. How do I do that in practice, right, at work? And that was the idea. Of course, you can go all over the internet and my guess is that most professional books are this way, right? That you're not necessarily producing a whole new insight. What you're trying to do is a bit of a curation, and you're standing on the shoulders of giants who've come before you. And 37 Signals is one you mentioned. I've mentioned GitLab a few times. I think I've mentioned the folks who wrote Apologies. And then a number of other people have done some work in the past. But the fact is that all of this work is scattered all over the web. And my job was to try and put all of the practices into a nice compact playbook, which people can refer to from time to time in their text.
That is one thing that I observed. I've been doing this podcast now for years because I read a lot of books in our space. And there is a common, this is just a statement, I guess, for our listeners, but there's a common phenomenon in which the author at the beginning of the book says, you don't have to read this end to end, just skip to the bit that you want to read. And without fail, universally, that means that this book is painful to read end to end because I'm constantly repeating myself. And you don't do that. I just want to call attention to that. You actually can read the book end to end, and it flows naturally, and it's a great read. But you also cover in each section exactly what you say you're going to cover, and so you can use it as a reference book. I very much appreciate that. Talking about reference, kind of a personal question here. The bibliography for this book is huge. How did you go about doing the research?
Well, the thing is, I've been doing research about this for a few years. The trigger for writing the book, however, came somewhere in the middle of the pandemic. So I've been fortunate in ways that I started working remotely much ahead of the pandemic. In my role as a product manager, I often tend to be and I work for a consultancy, right? So oftentimes I'm the only person who is playing my role on a development team. And a few years before the pandemic, I was in a role where I was the only product manager for a team of 50 that was spread all across Central and Eastern Europe. And, office-bound work was just pointless because there was nobody who could share a physical office with me. And so I, at the time, had been born and raised in the agile world, saying face-to-face communication is the most effective and efficient way of communicating. So very quickly, I saw myself inundated with lots of meetings when you start thinking about that model of work. And I realized that as a product manager, I want to start, defining hypotheses, building experiments, creating tests, building prototypes. And I was doing that on a second shift. And so I started reading about what others were doing to kind of get around this whole distributed work setup. And most of my reading happened in those pre-pandemic years. And then during the pandemic, I saw that my struggle in those pre-pandemic years had translated to everyone else. And if you try and empathize with the situation that I'm in, I work in India, and a lot of the people who work in India work in IT and in India, work in the services industry, and oftentimes serving clients in the West, right? And now try and imagine winters in the Northern Hemisphere. There is no overlap between somebody sitting in the West Coast of the US and India. When you're trying to overlap, you're taking a toll on people's personal lives. Never mind the toll that you take on deep work and anything of that sort, right? So I saw that effect being exacerbated across everyone. And then I felt like, all right, I've been able to do a little bit of reading. I've been able to take some of those and those learnings and apply them to my way of work. How about trying to put this together into a book? So yes, the bibliography is massive, but I didn't do that in the space of like 3 weeks or something like that. I did that maybe 4 or 5 years.
One of the things I observe when I'm dealing with senior leaders is that they get this stuff. They want their talented people. They want their clever people. They want their engineers working and solving problems, not sitting in meetings all of the time. And yet, in large organizations, these senior leaders who tend to be visionary, tend to be open-minded, tend to want the best for their people, have a layer of middle management between them and the people that they like to help. So the leaders say the right things, and then they don't understand why the ship's not turning. So I guess I'm trying to accomplish two things with this question, which is, what exactly is happening here, and how is your book designed to address that?
Yeah, so you are hitting the nail on the head there when you talk about the fact that top leadership understands that they'd like to retain talent, and they'd like to have that flexibility with talent, and they'd like to use their talent the most efficiently possible. Right? But that is a very meta and generic kind of a goal, right? And you need to be able to bring it down to the brass tacks of daily practices. Now, when you mention the middle management layer, whether by accident or design, you will notice that a lot of middle managers have not done a lot of hands-on work in, let's say, the last 3 or 4 years. All right? Which basically means that you might be managing a team of developers, but you probably haven't written code or done any pair programming recently. You've probably done some code reviews, but not much other than that. You probably looked at some architectural diagrams, but you haven't gotten to the thick of analysis. And so what happens is collaboration tools move at a very rapid pace. And during the pandemic, the uptake of that moved at a very rapid pace as well. I'll give you an example. So when we start projects, back in the day, we would do these workshops called inceptions. You might be familiar with the term, right? Mm-hmm. And back in the day, the way we would run inceptions was we would fly to a client location, book a client, right? And because now we had the room in a client's office booked, we'd fly a whole bunch of people in. And then we'd say, okay, now we've got 2 weeks booked. Let's just slam every possible session in, right? So your agenda would already be more bloated than what you need for the bare minimum information to start the project. Because that's really the goal, right? You want the bare minimum information to start the project. They've created a bloated agenda. So that's problem number one. The other problem is just a few things that you do, right? You've got to plaster the room with flip charts. You've got sticky notes up there. Oftentimes, you're referencing the output of one day on another day. And anyone who's facilitated in that kind of an environment knows that sticky notes fall off. And when they fall off, you don't know where they fell off from. So now, which quadrant do you put them back? These are real life, you know, brass tacks problems that practitioners face. Now, when you start facilitating the same kind of session in an online setting, you don't have to first cram so many sessions in the space of 2 weeks. You can say, well, let's do the most important things and we can do the long tail later. So that's a different way of looking at it. But the other thing is, once you start using Miro, you start understanding that now you don't have sticky notes falling, right? You don't have the whole scribing work to do after you've finished the work. You can actually get all of your stories from the story map straight into Jira if you've got the integration set up, right? But now, the only way you can think about all of these advancements is if you've used the tools. But if your last model of work was to go to a client site and conduct inceptions there, now that's the paragon of great collaboration for you. And I think that's where the gap is, that a lot of middle managers have done hands-on work maybe 3, 4, 5 years back, and they've not experienced what it is to do it with modern tools. And that's where some of the gap is between execution and management.
So it's middle managers who need to understand what tools are available and what the lack of those tools is the harm, the lack of those tools, or the opportunity that those tools present. But you also talk a lot about the inequity that forms inside of these global organizations because of the use of language, because of location and time zones and such. And so my question for you is, in an environment that has favored extroverted English speakers and promoted them to management positions, in which they get a sense of accomplishment from coming to work and using exactly those skills, their English language skills, their extroversion, in order to get through a day successfully just by doing meetings, how do you convince people who have succeeded in this environment to change the very rules, the very context that led to their own success?
Yeah, and that's an interesting one, right? And I think, call me naive if you will, at the end of the day, I believe everyone wants to do the right thing. So I don't know of a single company that doesn't say that they value diversity, right? So I'm hoping that there is that desire to put our money where our mouth is. And to a certain extent, I also believe that most people want to grow in their careers by learning things, by doing things better the next day than they did the previous day. Right? Now, there is a growing realization, at least amongst the people I sought input from, and I surveyed close to 2008, about 1,800 people in the course of my research, right? Mostly through surveys, but also through a lot of one-on-one conversations, talking to teams. And most people are indeed, bogged down by the number of meetings they do. And they profess that they don't have time for the work that they would like to do to be able to actually enhance their own skills. So you have people who are playing tech lead type of roles who would want to do a lot more mentoring, a lot more pairing, spend a lot more time doing in-depth pair reviews. But they're not able to do that. They're not able to look at their architecture. They're not able to look at ways to improve their code base. They are stuck in meetings. They would like to be able to do those things that improve their own skills. Now, of course, there's an egocentric part to leading where, yes, I'd like to be able to take center stage. But I've noticed that that's not necessarily the most important thing for most people. They realize that that's going to get them only so far in their careers. What's going to get them ahead is practicing their skills. Which is not to say that they don't want to be in any meetings. They just want to ensure the meetings that they have are really the meetings that they need.
For most of us, that might be a really ethnocentric thing to say to somebody working in India. Because as you said, you were doing this before the rest of us had to. But a lot of the listeners here are located in Europe and in America. And so when I say for most of us, I don't mean most of the world. I mean most of our listeners. For most of us, we were forced to move online. In 2020, we did it as a survival strategy. I don't think any company expected a performance boost as a way of doing it. They were just glad to be able to still have some revenues, to still stay in business. And yet we got a performance boost anyway. So given that, how do you explain this back to office movement that is coming right in the face of companies seeing the benefits of remote working?
Yeah, I mean, I wrote about this a few weeks back, and there are different phenomena at play. I can describe it the way I at least see it in India. In India, we have a number of these large companies. And the way I look at these large companies, and by the way, I'm not casting a shade on them as I say this, but we've got to recognize that in addition to being tech companies, they're also real estate companies because they own, they're not leasing real estate like many of us do. They actually own the premises. And to give you an example, one of the companies I used to work for back in the day, they own a 330-acre campus. There's no way you're going to be able to get rid of that. You need people on that campus. And if you don't have people on that campus, you're still incurring costs on it. Now, what happens when some of these larger companies start calling people back into the office because they have to, they can't leave their offices empty, is because of their size, they tend to be trendsetters. A lot of companies aspire to be like them when they grow up. That definitely is the case in India. And so, whether it makes sense for you or not, you say, well, all right, this big company is doing it. Why don't I do it as well, right? And do remember that sometimes amongst smaller companies, if you've, for example, recently gone public, your board is constituted with people who might be from those companies. So oftentimes you're also getting direction from those kinds of things. So a lot of these actions tend to be copycat actions because one of the big companies does it and you feel like if they're doing it, they must be right. So this happens in the West as well. Amazon's doing it. Amazon's calling people back into the office 3 days a week. They must be doing it right because we've been quoting Jeff Bezos all the time. So if we quoted Jeff Bezos all the time, it's cognitive dissonance not to listen to him now. And that's how this whole thing changes. But again, if a company if smaller companies, which are even in India, the majority, were to think for themselves, you would notice that office leasing costs are huge costs. They eat into a rather large share of your profits. For example, we in India exist in all of the expensive cities. And so you can imagine that office leasing costs are probably eating into at least 10% of our profits. So companies that are, let's say, smart enough to recognize those costs and also look at the data, right? In certain cases, the data might be clear that it's, you know, you're not getting any benefit out of remote work. But if the data tells you that your people are happier and you are actually getting good enough or even better results by being remote, then that's something to consider. Do you really want to keep incurring those 10% extra costs?
Now, I'm glad that you mentioned data because that's my next question, which is that there is this pressure that a lot of companies feel, and it may very well come from exactly where you say, from following the leaders that they've been following all along, to come back to the office. And you make a wonderful case that that can be damaging. In fact, it's a wonderful opportunity for smaller companies that don't have all of this infrastructure investment that they have to utilize in order to compete with the larger companies for talent. Certainly, Microsoft has some wonderful people, but they're mostly in Seattle. And if their policies cause them to lose good people in India, well, that's an opportunity for everyone else. So I'm wondering if you have any ideas how HR departments or managers in these companies that are facing pressure from their boards or from their senior leadership to return to the office can put in place metrics to weigh the benefits and the consequences of that policy so that they might be able to push back.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's where experiments help, where, for example, when you start looking at consulting firms, which happen to be a large percentage of firms that exist in India, and a lot of firms do consulting work in the West as well, where you're building software not just for you, not for yourself, but for somebody else. So now think about it. There might be clients who are mandating that you have to be on their premises. You can contrast them with clients who give you flexibility to work from anywhere. And if you're able to do some sort of an analysis comparing one group of workers that has flexibility with another group of workers that is a little more office bound, and you're able to get that data out, because that data can't be one-dimensional, right? That data can't just be around, all right, these many story points and this percentage of bugs and that. Of course, those are metrics to worry about. But you also need to temper that with metrics around people's happiness, their satisfaction at work, right? And when you start weighing those together, do you see a noticeable difference that takes you either way, right? And you make the decision in the direction of the data, where you have two kinds of teams to compare. And that's indeed what I was doing when I was trying to do my own research, which is to check what happens when you have no location flexibility, no time flexibility. What impact does it have on diversity? What impact does it have on people's satisfaction? What impact does it have on people's ability to say that they are getting time for people? And the difference was stark, because to tell you even just one metric, teams that don't have time flexibility, they are 33% less diverse on the gender front, which means in general, they'll have a third less women because their time is so rigid.
We know from Anita Woolsey's work that not only reduces the potential labor force, it also reduces the collective intelligence of the team.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, in fact, there's Devon Santola's work on this as well, wherein he talks about the critical mass that you need for diversity to work, right? For example, if you have any less than 25% women on the team, all those women are mostly going to conform to behave the way the men on the team behave. You get the tipping point only after you've crossed the 25% mark. So you've got to do everything you can to be able to have representative diversity on your teams, where your teams are somehow a microcosm of the society that they exist in.
All right, I've got one last question for the first half of this interview, which is the high-level part. And that is that one point that you made, it really resonated with me because I've been in this business for, 25 years now. And it is that we're not doing the same work that we used to do. When I started, when you started, we were building simple CRUD applications, you know, simple web applications. And those were exciting because the web wasn't interactive before then. And when we faced challenges there, the solution was simple. You put your best engineers in a room and give them an unlimited pizza and coffee budget, and they solve the problem. But now with artificial intelligence and machine learning, the complexity of the problems that we are solving in IT these days, on average, is so much higher than the systems that we work in were originally designed for. So how does remote and specifically async working provide better environments for this very complex problem solving?
Yeah, and I think that's where the idea of asynchronous work starts to overlap with the idea of deep work, wherein my argument is that if you're trying to deal with higher complexity, you need undivided attention for large periods of time. And in XP, I think you have a bunch of tools that allow you to do that. Right? So for example, there are inviolate hours that a number of teams practice where you already say that, well, this is the time that we're going to work without any interruptions. For example, on many of the teams I've worked on, those are what we call core pairing hours, where practicing pair programming, two people are keeping each other accountable, and you're doing this without any interruptions. Now, one can argue that pairing introduces a little bit of a rigidity in your schedule, but I think that can happen with some level of empathy where you decide what amount of time you want to yourself and what amount of time you want to spend with a coworker trying to thrash out things. But the idea is that if you're going to punctuate your day with a meeting here and a meeting here and a meeting here, that's very difficult to get your head stuck into a complex problem. As you know, we learned back in the day, anything, a developer needs 4-hour blocks of time to get their head stuck into a complex problem. It's the same with a designer. It's the same with a product manager. And if you can do this without the interruption of constant instant messages, digital presenteeism, lots of meetings, at least you have one tool up. And then you start to wet that uninterrupted block of time with the tools that XP already gives you, which is to break down your problem into smaller bits, do test-driven development, clean code, pair programming, and you can actually have a pretty potent mix to start dealing with.
That is a wonderful point at which to end the first half of the interview, because I'm going to be picking up the second half of the interview with a follow-on question to that. Well, doesn't that just titillate the imagination? I don't know if you're like me. I hate days full of Zoom meetings. I simply can't do it. More than 3 hours and I just break down. And so the idea is, listeners, those of you who are Patreon subscribers may remember the bonus episode that I did on Patrick Lencioni's, what was it called? Death by Meeting, his book Death by Meeting, in which he painted a picture of meetings as being a place in which people have impassioned discussions about things that matter, not a place where people simply sit back and listen to other people make reports. And I would love to live in that world. I would love to live in that world, one in which I got to consume my information when I wanted to and think about it as much as I wanted to, as long as I wanted to, and respond at my own pace, and only showed up to a meeting when I really cared about the topic and I could have an impact on the outcome. And so if you like that, if you found that interesting, if you found that titillating, if you'd like to learn how to make that happen, tune in 2 weeks for the second half of this interview, in which we are going to take a deep dive into the details of the book and some of those key takeaways and how you actually can make this happen for yourself, for your team, and for your company. And if you like these ideas, I would encourage you to get the book. You've got 2 weeks, which is plenty of time to read it. You can read ahead, and that way, when you join us for the deep dive into the book, you'll have more context for the conversation. And Sumit has been nice enough to share with me a discount code, which will give you 35% off the book until December 11th. So this is your chance to get the book at a deep, deep discount. The discount code is Agile Book Club, all capitals, no spaces. And you can use that discount code to purchase the book for 35% off at www.informit.com/async. The link will be in the show notes. So join us again in 2 weeks. And until then, just remember, the call for papers is still open for the ACE conference. So if you've got a story to share, go to aceconf.com and let us know about it. We'd love to hear from you. Till next time, this is Paul with the Agile Book Club signing off. Goodbye.